Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Prasky. Maybe the most amazing thing about Charlie Parker, besides the fact that he revolutionized jazz, is that he managed to do it in just 34 years, because that's exactly how long he lived. But what a life! Chuck Haddix, in his new biography of Parker, says, boy, did Parker live! One friend said the great saxophonist packed more into life than anybody else. Today, a look at our Charlie Parker, who hails from Kansas City. He played with the great Jay McShann, and who, even on this day, is remembered behind the Blue Room in the 18th and Vine District with a stunning monument to the man who created bebop. Chuck Haddix's new book is titled Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. Chuck is the host of The Fish Fry, heard here on Friday and Saturday evenings. And Chuck, welcome and congratulations on the new book. What a great, great feat.
Well, thank you, Steve. You know, it's really a pleasure to be sitting down here with a fellow. We can be jazz cats, you know.
All hour long, can't we? Just talk jazz, and that's my world. I really enjoy it. Well, why did they call him Bird, Chuck?
Well, you know, originally, it's interesting that the term originates. A lot of what's been written about Charlie Parker, about his Kansas City time, has been inaccurate.
Yeah,
you know,
that's why you wrote the book ultimately, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I wrote the book. The book is an outgrowth of my Kansas City jazz book. When I did the Kansas City jazz book, I dedicated two chapters to Bird, and I thought, this deserves a more robust treatment. And there had never really been a really great biography written about Bird. And so I just seized that opportunity. But he got his name. He went to Penn School in Westport, which was the first school west of the Missouri River to educate African Americans. And it was located on the rock outcropping right across from the Vietnam veterans. And according to childhood friends, they were doing a production called Birdland, believe it or not. And it was a three-room schoolhouse, and Charlie and the other kids were out, other boys were out playing, and the teacher stepped out and said, "Hey, you little yardbirds, come on in here." You know, it's a colloquialism for chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bird loved chickens, so he always referred to it as yard bird.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Jay McShann talks about how when they were on the road, you know, he would say, "A chicken ain't nothing but a yard bird," instead of "a chicken ain't nothing but a bird." And they were going to, while he was a member of the Jay McShann band, they were going to play a dance in Lincoln for the Big Red game for Nebraska. And on the way, the car he was riding in ran over a chicken. And he said, "Stop. We can't waste this chicken." So he went back and got the yard bird. And then, you know, of course, in those days, they couldn't stay in hotels if there wasn't a hotel in the African-American community. So they were staying with some in a boarding house. And he got there and he asked a woman to please cook me that yard bird. And it's kind of interesting because later on, his name was shortened to Bird, which you know, implies something that's otherworldly, something lighter than air. But he started out as a little chicken running around in the yard of Penn School.
He changed the music how, Chuck?
Well, there's music before and after Charlie Parker. He's a transitional figure in music, much like Louis Armstrong and John Coltrane a little bit later on in Ellington. Only he changed... he not only contributed to he changed the direction of music with the development of bebop, which is a new way of playing jazz. A faster way.
Mm-hmm.
Filled up, used 16th notes, playing off of changes of popular songs. He would often quote popular songs, but he and Dizzy Gillespie really, it was a revolution in music. But what I find interesting about Bird is that he not only influenced jazz musicians and changed the course of jazz, he influenced a whole generation of poets, sculptors, painters, you know, artists.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Kerouac talks about, in Mexico City Blues, talks about, "I want to blow 100, I think it's 124 choruses, you know, like on a jazz afternoon," you know. And also, he's a character in Kerouac's Subterraneans. And Kerouac talks about seeing Bird on the stand and Bird looking into his eyes to see if he was that great writer he thought himself to be, you know. And you know, he appears in literature, art. He just changed everything.
It's no question there's music before Charlie Parker. There's music after Charlie Parker. He's that important to jazz.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah, that's just amazing.
Everybody that picked up a horn, an instrument, after Charlie Parker was influenced by Bird. His impact was that profound.
You know, there is a club out in New York City in Manhattan. It's called Birdland. Even today, one of the most prominent jazz clubs in New York. Players of the music today regard Charlie Parker how, Chuck?
Well, he's a revered figure.
Yeah.
One of the most daunting things about writing a book about a biography of Charlie Parker is he's such a significant figure in our culture and in music. You know, how do you do this individual justice? He's a hard act to follow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And but you did it anyway because, again, you wanted to set the record straight.
That's correct. I want to tell the story of his story. You know, very little had been written about Charlie's life in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that's been wrong. Most of the people that have written about him never visited Kansas City, did research here. And he lived the first 21 years of his life in Kansas City, and he only lived to be 34.
So we shaped him in so many ways.
Yeah, he's a culmination of the Kansas City tradition. He comes out of the late-night cutting contests, like still happen at the Mutual Musicians Foundation, happen in rough-and-tumble places like the Reno Club, where young musicians tested their mettle by sitting in with older musicians. And he's a culmination of that tradition. He's also a great... His gift is as an improviser. He seemed like a fountain of musical ideas that came out of his horn whenever he played. Accounts of seeing him on stage are consistent in that he was brilliant.
Huh. Let's get a sense of what that brilliance is all about. This is Charlie Parker, and this song is Hootie Blues. Tell me about that song, Hootie Blues. Who's singing there, and when was it recorded, Chuck?
It was recorded in April 1941, and that was Walter Brown singing, and of course that's a landmark first commercially recorded solo by Charlie.
And Charlie, is that right?
Charlie had actually made a couple of other recordings before that. One of them is called Honey Body. It's Honey, Body and Soul, and Honeysuckle Rose. And then also John Tumino recorded the band playing Margie and I'm Getting Sentimental Over You 2 months before this session. And it's a previously unknown recording we have in the Marsh Sound Archives. Huh. And I played it at the International Association of Jazz Record Collectors conference a few weeks back, about a month back, and as part of a Charlie Parker in Kansas City recordings. And Bob Porter and Mark Cantor and a few of the other jazz cats just blew them away. Hmm. We're hoping to get that published so that everybody can enjoy it. It's just a marvelous performance.
And this is the Jay McShann band that we just heard, too.
Yeah, actually,
Jay's old band.
It's a flip side of the big hit Confessing the Blues,
oh, yeah,
which
sure.
really established the band. And musicians in the know flipped the record over, and when they hear Bird's solo on that, they just all flipped out because it was so different than any other alto saxophone. It was fresh and it was new.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Bird co-wrote that. Believe it or not, with Jay McShann. That's one of the things he co-wrote with McShann.
You know, so just to be clear, so if we're talking to a player from Denmark right now, a professional saxophone player from Denmark, he'd know exactly who Charlie Parker was.
Oh, yeah. Charlie Parker's known actually more around the world than he is known in Kansas City. It's the irony. It's the old prophet in your hometown.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we all experience that.
Yeah.
You know, for me... you know, I do papers at academic conferences. I, you know, write books, and yet I'm the fish fry guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
And you know, that's just the way it is. But Parker is the same way. He's known internationally, and he's always linked to Kansas City. He's always associated with Kansas City.
Huh. You know, but there still is, Chuck, a central mystery about Charlie Parker, and you write about this in Bird, your new book, and. That is this notion that early on in his life, Charlie Parker wasn't a very good player. The other players around town didn't want to be around him. And then he takes off for the Ozarks to play at a place down there. And this proves to be a pivotal moment for him for a couple of reasons. One, there's a car accident that changes Charlie's life, and it's not for the better. And then something else, and that is that something magical happens to Parker, because down in the Ozarks, he learns how to play and to play spectacularly. So, Chuck, what happened down there in the Ozarks to Charlie Parker? It's sort of like Robert Johnson at the crossroads, and what happened to him there? What happened to Charlie Parker in the Ozarks?
Well, there's a number of watershed events in his life, and it all starts at the Reno Club. And in spring—
In Kansas City.
In Reno Club on 12th Street. And they had a spook breakfast there. It was a jam session where musicians would come sit in, and it would start on 4 o'clock Sunday morning, go all day Monday. And, you know, Charlie Parker's coming up at a time when the city is populated with, Lester Young, just all these great players.
Great
Walter
folks.
Page,
yeah.
Mary Lou Williams. I mean, I could just go on and on. And he's coming up at that time, coming of age musically.
And the town is full of clubs. There's a zillion opportunities to play at that time.
That's right. But mm-hmm. he's a product. He comes up out of the Lincoln High School. But he's not very adept at first. But then again, he's only 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he's at the Reno Club. And he falters during a solo playing Honeysuckle Rose.
I was going to ask about this.
And Joe Jones throws a cymbal at his feet to show the displeasure. And he was laughed off the stage. And
Joe Jones, the drummer, throws a cymbal. And this is the ultimate put down for a musician.
Oh, yeah. It's like the old getting the old hook in vaudeville days.
Yeah.
And he was humiliating publicly. And Gene Ramey talked about in an interview about how Parker said, "I'll show these cats." And so he was on his way to a gig at Mooser's Ozark Tavern, which is 5 miles south of Eldon, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And he was traveling with Ernest Daniels and Mr. Clarence Mooser, who's a very colorful figure. And there was this horrible automobile wreck.
The car flips like five times, right? I mean, it's just terrible.
Oh, yeah, it was horrible. It threw, killed George Wilkerson, and it broke Bird's back and a bunch of his ribs. And the doctor prescribed heroin for it. In an interview with his first wife, Rebecca Ruffin, that's when he gets addicted to heroin when he's 16 years old. And he's been smoking reefers, and all these narcotics are readily available because of Kansas City.
And the doctor at the time knew this could be trouble, but didn't really know what else to do, if I understand correctly.
Well, the heroin was thought to be a safe alternative to morphine for a long time, and they didn't really have anything else to give him. And so the next summer, he goes to Mooser's Ozarks Tavern with the George E. Lee Band. And the thing about Mooser's in that area, that's Little Dixie. You know, they're sundown communities, African Americans. they can't be caught down there after dark. Mm-hmm. And it's a long journey. So he stayed on site, and he practiced, and he learned the changes of all the chords, you know, all the chord changes. Mm-hmm. And he practiced diligently. He was a very disciplined musician. And when he came back, he was a changed man, according to Gene Ramey and everybody else on the scene. Also, he had this raggedy old saxophone. Yeah. And what he would do is, if people talk about him, the rubber bands on the saxophone, he would change out the springs for rubber bands to give it faster action. And he used cellophane over the keys to give it faster action. And then he'd do all
and
kinds
he put
of tricks.
Cork in the keys, too, to give him a shorter distance between the key and the horn itself, right, to make allow him to play faster, too, I think.
That's correct. And Buster Smith taught him how to do that. And when he came back, he rose very quickly. You know, by the time he was 18 years old, he's playing with, Buster Smith, Jay McShann. He plays with Harlan Leonard. The myth about Charlie Parker is he was not appreciated during his time in his hometown when actually he was a big star. When I went through the call, when I did my Kansas City book, I found all these references where he talked about saxophonist supremacist, and they called him Little Charlie Parker in those days. And he was a big star locally. Everybody knew Charlie Parker. And, you know, also there's this myth that he never wanted to go back to Charlie Parker, to Kansas City, rather, when he left. But he often returned here on his way from the West Coast to hustle up, because he'd spent all his money and needed to hustle up some money, and he could stay with his mother over on Olive Street and hustle up some money by playing Tootie's Mayfair, which was out in the county.
You just wonder, you know, reading his story, again, that stay in the Ozarks, so pivotal to his development, you just wonder exactly what happened down there. Was it just as simple as him practicing diligently to become the bird that took flight, I guess?
Oh, yeah, sure. And you know, you got to consider, Mooser's is a big resort. It's not a roadhouse. I mean, there's 14 English Tudor cottages there, and they've got a crystal ballroom where they played. And he played every night, too, and he played with a band of top musicians led by George E. Lee. So not only playing every night, he's woodshedding, too. Mm-hmm. He's what you call going to the woodshed, where he goes and he practices.
Chuck Haddix is our guest. His new book is titled Bird, the Life and Music of Charlie Parker. You can see Chuck next Wednesday at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information about that event, kcur.org. Just look for Up to Date. Bobby Watson will be appearing with Chuck next Wednesday. Jim Mayer, Herman Mahari, a bunch of other players too, right?
Yeah, James Albright and Jürgen Veld. What it's going to be, I hope this is a start of something, because what we're going to do, we're going to celebrate the life and music of Charlie Parker. And it's something that we haven't done here enough. Mm-hmm. I was recently, in August, it'll be a book signing too, of course. Got to get that plug in. In August, I went to the Charlie Parker Festival in New York City.
Huh.
And it was just amazing. It was the 21st annual. It was a free festival. I saw Jimmy Heath Big Band at Marcus Garvey Park up in Harlem. Saw Sheila Jordan and Lee Konitz at Tompkins Square Park, where Bird lived on Avenue B. Walked over to the apartment. I was with my friend Russ Dantzler, and just had a ball. And people turned out. And people, it was a real celebration of Bird. And that's what needs to happen here. We need to celebrate Bird more.
Yeah.
And maybe we can – I'm thinking we can do things a little bit differently next year. I'm certainly hoping that we can, because people from all over the world come here. Bird's buried here.
Yeah, Bird's here.
And another thing that's kind of interesting about Bird that I found out that is previously unknown is Bird lived in Midtown. You know,
really?
He lived
where?
35th and Wyandotte, and mm-hmm. also on 34th. There were two apartment buildings where his family lived when he went to Penn School.
Still there?
Yeah, they're still there. Mm-hmm. 1927 and 1932, and both places are still there.
Oh, wow.
And you can see him. One of them's got a nice plaque on it, and people are living in it, and that's where he lived.
The museum used to have an annual gathering at Parker's gravesite in the cemetery just east of town every August to celebrate his birthday, I guess. And I've been to four or five of those things. Absolutely terrific events. They've sort of faded away. And they shouldn't fade away. They used to polish it off with a jam session back at the foundation. It was always just a great time, a chicken dinner, and it was just fun.
I think the thing about it is that Charlie Parker's birthday celebration is like everybody's child. In reality, is nobody's child.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think we need to have an effort, you know, incorporating the American Jazz Museum. Got an interest in that. They've got a good, great display down there. And I think we need to come together as a city and celebrate Bird's birthday, maybe shut down 18th Street.
Yeah.
And just have it. And have the local cats play. You know, I mean, we've got such world-class musicians that live here. And just start it modestly, a one-day festival. And maybe even do it at Boca Park. Who knows?
Let's see where it goes. Chuck Haddix is our guest. His new book, Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. If you want to join our conversation, maybe you have a question about Bird, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate, at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at kcur, UpToDate. You know, he's also a man of incredible contradictions. And you write about this in the book, Chuck. He was generous but miserly. He was a loving husband and father, but an obsessive philanderer. He was an addict, and yet he lectured younger musicians about the dangers of drugs. He rarely showed up on time, but once he did, he took charge on stage. He was a high school dropout, but well-read and well-spoken. That's a lot of contradictions in one mouthful, boy.
You know, he was an interesting couple of guys, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the challenges of writing about Bird, because he had a way of empathizing with the people he talked to and connecting with them one-on-one. If you read Robert Reisner's book, it's like there's 82 different Birds there.
Hmm.
You know, and that's one of the challenges of writing about him. Of course, we're all a mixed bag, but his, I think, was more pronounced. One of the things that interested me, and I didn't really want to sensationalize his narcotics use, because God knows Ross Russell did enough to sensationalize Charlie Parker's life with his biography.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, Charlie Parker's life didn't need to be sensationalized. That's one of the things that I found, is I just tried to present tell his story without mm-hmm. judging or without inserting a lot of writers will insert themselves into it,
right.
their opinions. I just tried to tell this story straight, and so you really get a feeling about the contradictions of the man and how he dealt with those contradictions too, and the consequences of his addictions and
yeah.
his alcoholism. And then also, you know, he had mental health issues. He spent 6 months in Camarillo. He tried to kill himself at one time. Commit suicide. He was in Bellevue later in life. And a lot of that, of course, I think was brought on by his drinking and his narcotics use. I mean, it's a very fascinating story.
816-235-2888. Charlie Parker, the great jazz sax player, our guest, our topic here this morning, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Dan from Independence. Dan, you're on UpToDate with Chuck Haddix. Good morning.
Hi, you guys. Glad to hear the subject is Charlie Parker. I wondered if you're aware. He's buried in Lincoln Cemetery, and I go by there regularly every
yeah.
once in a while. Drop by and look at his grave site. But I wonder if you could tell the story why he's not buried in New York and he's actually buried in Kansas City.
Why is he here, Chuck?
Well, originally, when he passed, he had split from Chan. He was no longer living in Chan. He'd been kind of cut adrift.
His second
anchor.
Wife, right?
It was fourth wife.
Fourth wife, excuse
but,
me.
But he remained married to Rebecca and to Doris when he had these other wives. And what happened was Chan made arrangements for him to be buried in New York, and his mother interceded because she wanted to bring Charlie back here.
Addie, right?
Addie interceded. And she, according to relatives, she buried him under a tree in Lincoln Cemetery. So he would always be in the shade. And she wanted to be buried next to him.
Mm-hmm.
And her legal claim endorses his second wife's legal claim. His other wife's legal claim trumped Chan's. And so he was brought back to Kansas City. And he was buried by Norman Granz paid for his funeral because he was broke.
Is that
and
right?
And it was members of Local 627 that carried him to his final resting place.
No kidding.
Yeah, and you know, he's mother's love will always triumph. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Dan, good phone call. Let's take a break. Let's go out with some music, some Charlie Parker music. This one is a jazz standard. It's called Cherokee. Charlie Parker. Thank you. this hour, we're talking with Chuck Haddix. He's the host of The Fish Fry about his new book, Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. That music we just heard of Bird, that was played here. That was recorded here in Kansas City, right?
Yeah, that's from 1943. And what's interesting about it was recorded by Vic Damon in Damon Studios. And Bird had just left the Earl Father Hines Band, and where he'd been working with Dizzy Gillespie, and he comes back to Kansas City, and he's playing with Winston Williams and Step Buddy Anderson at Tootie's Mayfair. Hmm. And Effort G. Ware is featured on guitar, and the drummer is Little Phil, which is Charlie's heroin connection here locally. Little Phil lost his mind and spent time in St. Joe later in his life. Huh. And it's just a casual session, much like a jam session. But what's wonderful about that performance, that's from the Norman Sachs collection, is it shows Bird at really the top of his game. You've got to consider all the elements of bebop are there in that solo. Mm-hmm. Yet he and Gillespie are yet to develop it. He'd already had that language and that approach. And all the things that made Bird so interesting, like he quotes T for Two. He was known for quoting popular songs when he was soloing on stage. A woman would walk in, a pretty woman, and he loved women. And he would quote, "A pretty girl is like a melody." Uh-huh. And, you know, it's a wonderful performance. And, you know, Cherokee was his favorite song. He was known, you know, sometimes he would show, well, he was rather irregular on the bandstand, you might say. And whenever he would show up late, and I write about this in the book, about, I think I quote Ross Russell, where they're playing at Billy Berg's and the band is on the stage, but things aren't complete because Bird's not there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the band plays a couple of tunes and everybody's looking around, where's Bird? And all of a sudden they break into Cherokee, and in walks Bird through the front door blowing his horn and walks up to the stage. You know, if you're going to be late, you might as well make a grand entrance.
Grand entrance, and he was late a lot, right? Let's go to Marvin from Kansas City, Kansas. Marvin, you're on with Chuck Haddix. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I wanted to mention something that's related to Charlie Parker, and you've spoken a little bit about how much he's influenced people, and I saw a wonderful YouTube video the other day of, it was Ray Charles, I believe he was in San Paulo in the 50s, playing saxophone, and he was imitating the voicings of Charlie Parker. And one, I didn't know that Ray was a decent sax player, which he seemed to be, and two, it just clearly indicates another, you know, example of who all he's influenced and how far-reaching that was, even, you know, in the 50s with people like Ray Charles, who was really not known as a jazz sax player.
Yeah, and also today, I mean, his influence still is prevalent. I mean, he's you know, I kind of vacillate between Miles Davis being one of the more significant figures in jazz because he was the forefront of so many movements, but then Bird, he just changed everything.
So does Bird deserve the most credit for bebop? Or, I mean, again, the credit usually goes to Dizzy Gillespie and Bird. I mean, you're saying, does Bird really deserve the credit for it?
Yeah. You know, they at Minton's in Harlem, there was a longtime jam session led by Thelonious Monk and Kenny Clark, the drummer, Klug. Mm-hmm. And by the time Bird arrived in Kansas City, he'd already developed the vocabulary of bebop on his own. And if you read Gillespie's biography and accounts from the first encounter from Step Buddy Anderson, for example, they first met in, I think it was 1941 in July. Cab Calloway band came to town, and Gillespie was a member of that band, and Gillespie was already had experimenting with his advanced ideas. And Step Buddy Anderson made arrangements for them to meet at 19th and Vine in front of the old Kentucky Barbecue. And they met and they walked around the corner. And Gillespie didn't play for them. He wanted to hear what Bird and Buddy would do. And Buddy had advanced ideas, too, at the same time. I mean, he was nip and tuck with Bird. And Gillespie was blown away by Bird because Bird was way ahead of him at that time.
Mm. And even though he didn't really show it at the moment, your book points out that there was some uncertainty as to exactly how Dizzy regarded Bird after hearing him play.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Buddy Anderson.
At the foundation. They were actually at the foundation together. You can go there today and see where they got together.
Yeah, they were upstairs. And Buddy Anderson said that felt that Gillespie was not impressed with them, that he was the greatest jazzer in the room.
That Dizzy was, yeah.
But Dizzy Dizzy, in his autobiography, talks about how blown away he was by what Bird was doing at the time. He said he was way ahead of what. But, you know, these guys, it's like they came together as one heartbeat, and together they lifted each other up, really.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people that were experimenting with Bob, the changes and everything, but they were quickly became the front runners in the movement, and the ones that would take it to the broader audience.
You know, Scott emails us this, Chuck. He wants to know about Parker's KCK roots, and he does have some roots in KCK. Tell us about that.
Well, he was born in Kansas City, Kansas, on Freeman, 8th and Freeman. And a lot of people assume that he was born in the house. Actually, he was born in a two-room apartment above a grocery store on the corner.
Is it still there?
No, it's gone now, unfortunately. And he lived in – he attended Douglas School. And his grandmother lived on Washington, 8th and Washington. And so he spent a lot of time with his half-brother, Ike, in that area. And the family moved in 27. They moved to Wyandotte, 35th and Wyandotte in Kansas City, Missouri. So he spent the first 7 years of his life there.
I'm wondering, where else in Kansas City are there some sort of landmark places where he spent time that might still be around today the area?
There's the two residences. You can Google them and find them. A lot of people assume that Olive – there were two residences he lived on Olive. He lived at 1516 Olive with Addie, and it was a two-story brick house that she rented. And then when he came back to town after in 43, I believe it was, they lived at 1535 Olive, which was an apartment building at the corner. There's, of course, the Penn School. There's a plaque where Penn School was. Most of the buildings are gone, unfortunately. You know, he was a member of the Mutual Musicians Foundation, Local 627. In those days, he joined when he was 15 years old. Wow. To play a gig with George E. Lee. So he was a professional musician. That building's still there. A lot of the buildings on 18th Street, you can kind of almost hear Bird's echoes.
You know, I'm wondering about the style, his new style, and how well or how questioning with which it was received. I mean, what did the other players think of this new way of playing that Bird brought to the music?
Well, there was there were two schools of music. Louis Armstrong really disliked Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, they don't know how to dress. They blow their lip out. You know, this is – he called it jiu-jitsu music. And so a lot of the older players resisted – it was generational – resisted bebop. But the younger musicians that came up were very much got on the bandwagon. And they at one point, I go into it in the book, there's a battle of the bands in New York City where you have these traditionalists playing, you know, Sweet Sue, Sweet You, and all this stuff, and you have the boppers playing bop. And it's built as against the modernists and the oldie figs. And in the end, Barry Ulanoff, who is not given enough credit as a jazz writer, wrote for Metronome in the 30s, said that this really went a long way towards bringing jazz together again.
I would have loved to have heard those two styles playing off each other like that.
Well, they were playing the same tunes, only one was playing bebop and the other's playing a traditional style, New Orleans style.
Wow. Chuck Caddix is our guest. His new book, Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. Again, you can see and meet Chuck next 7 o'clock next Wednesday evening at Unity Temple on the Plaza. More information at kcur.org. Just look for Up to Date. Bobby Watson will perform that evening. Herman Mahari, Jim Mayer, and several others as well. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. How long did Charlie Parker play with our own Jay McShann?
He played with Jay McShann on two different occasions. One place another club where he played that's still there is he played at Martin's 210 West 47th Street.
Wow.
Which was an Argentinian steakhouse, I think.
It's no longer there, obviously.
No, it's still there.
It is still there.
The building's still there. Martin's was a
on the plaza.
Yeah, Martin's was a popular gathering spot for the country club set. It was Art Deco, well appointed with leather booths and stools. And what they would do, there was a cafeteria behind it, and after hours they would move over to the cafeteria and the Jay McShann band would play. And he was with Jay for a brief while, about 1938 or so. And then, of course, he joined Harlan Leonard from – one of the things that I was able to do is straighten out his chronology in town. Then he went to the Harlan Leonard Band, and he he had struggled in the Harlan Leonard band. He really struggled in that because he was so unreliable, and Harlan Leonard was grooming his band for national success. So Harlan fired him, and he wasn't getting along with Rebecca or his mother. And his mother told him, "There's no, we can't have two unpleasant people here. You've got to go." And so he went to New York, where he reunited with Buster Smith, his musical father, whom he'd played with in 1938 at Lucille's Paradise. And then when his father dies, he comes back to Kansas City in 1940. And that's when he rejoins the McShann Band.
Huh. Back to some phone calls here. Brent from Leawood. Brent, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Great show.
Thanks.
I calling to give you what is it sounds like an urban legend, but it's not, because I've heard some of these recordings. There was a guy when Charlie was playing in New York who would go into the club early on before people were showing up. He'd go in one of the toilet stalls with a tape recorder, and he ran his mic up through the ceiling. It was some sort of drop ceiling. I don't know what they had in those days, but the microphone was above the bandstand, and he would turn on the record on the tape recorder only when Charlie would take a solo. And so, you know, he's got all these solos strung together. You wouldn't get the rest of the tune, but I know it happened because I've heard some of the recordings. They're a little bit crude sounding, but they're just fantastic work. And
hang on a second, Brent, because Chuck's shaking his head here. Tell me about what you're thinking, Chuck.
It's not true.
He didn't do it in bathroom stalls. He would set up in front of the bandstand. And he recorded.
That would be a lot easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Dean Benedetti's who you're talking about. And when Bird went to play at Billy Berg's in 1946, Dean Benedetti was leading a band, the Streets of Paris, out there. And it was a transformative experience for him, too. He actually gave up the horn and started following Charlie Parker from club to club and recording him. And he would just record the solo. Mm-hmm. But these were recorded to acetate discs. The whole thing about the wire recordings and all that, that comes from Ross Russell. And Ross Russell, unfortunately, at the urging of Albert Goldman, incorporated fictive elements into his novel. He made up whole stretches of things to make it more sensational, more dramatic, and that's one of them. Later on, he got an open reel tape, and they threw him out of the threw Dean out of the Three Deuces when Bird was playing on 52nd Street because he wasn't buying enough drinks. And Dean was a good friend of Bird's, but it's a true story, but the elements that Russell incorporated aren't true.
I see. Well, now
you can hear it because it's all been reissued on the Mosaic record label. We have it in the Sound Archive.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's a great story, and I think I heard some of those in the KU Listening Library one time.
So. Yeah. All right.
Brent,
thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Can't wait to get the book.
You bet.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye bye.
I want to hear some more music from Charlie Parker. I want to listen to Groovin' High. This would be with Gillespie, I assume?
Yeah, this is with Gillespie.
A classic jazz tune, right?
Yeah, recorded for the Guild label. And what's interesting about this is Gillespie and Parker were very different individuals on bandstand and off bandstand.
Mm-hmm.
Gillespie was a showman. He was criticized repeatedly for bumping and grinding and clowning on stage and all this, where Bird was very kind of reserved. But off stage, you know, Gillespie had a very conservative lifestyle, and Bird, you know, was kind of a wild man, you know.
Yeah.
And when they came together for this Guild session, this is where you first hear bebop being recorded, because there was a recording band, and this is recorded on the heels of that. And the band comes together for a wonderful performance on this. And they come together in what Gillespie described as one heartbeat.
This is Groovin' High. You know, Chuck, if you had had a chance to interview someone like Charlie Parker, I'm sure as a biographer there are all kinds of things you would have liked to have known. What would you have asked him? What did you want to know?
I would want to know, when he felt he made his first breakthrough would be one thing I'd want to know. And also, you know, towards the end of his life, it's marred by tragedy. His daughter Pri died. She had cystic fibrosis. Mm. And it just crushed him because he wasn't there when she was born. He wasn't there when she died. And it changed his relationship with Chan. I would ask him about that, you know, how he felt, because I think that was a lot of unresolved feelings about the loss of Pri.
Chuck Caddix's new book, Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. It is always a pleasure to have you here, Chuck. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve, for giving me a little time, man. And we hope to see you next Wednesday night, man.
Next Wednesday at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza, a book signing for Chuck's new book. Bobby Watson will be there. Thanks again.
Blowing the roof off the place.
You bet.